Welcome to Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams from Cricut Media. I'm your host, Stacey Abrams. Welcome back to our show. I hope everyone had a good holiday season, but now it's time to get back to work because we are mere weeks away from Trump's inauguration. My niece Faith, who many of you know helped me launch Assembly Required, was home from her first semester in college. We spent more time catching up on Silo and Cross, both are really good shows, than talking politics. But she did share how she was adjusting after the election. Namely, we talked about how to process what she was hearing, about the appointments, about deportations, about what the real reach of the presidency is. Look, they both have about 4 years, Faith and Trump. The question is, what will he do with his and how will it affect hers? For all of us, the specter of the unknown is not just terrifying, it's paralyzing. And it's enraging that someone else might determine our destiny. But like I told Faith, he has some power, but no one has all of the power. Our job is to pool what we've got and see what we can make happen. One of the places where the unknown meets shared power is how we can prepare for what will happen on the environment. It's far from the only area where the outgoing and incoming presidents have distinctly opposite visions, but it is definitely one of the most consequential. Just as a quick reminder, in his first term, Trump pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accords. He rolled back over 100 environmental regulations domestically. He has also consistently called climate change a hoax. President Biden passed the largest piece of climate legislation in history through the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, which invested nearly $400 billion into reducing emissions, shoring up clean energy, and creating jobs. Just this week, President Biden took further action to protect both the East and the West Coast from offshore drilling. With this announcement, President Biden has now conserved over 670 million acres of America's lands and waters. Basically, every Biden climate policy is already a target for Trump's second term. Like that offshore drilling ban Biden just announced this Monday, Trump has already told Hugh Hewitt on his radio show that he'll change it on day one.
I see it just came over that Biden has banned all oil and gas drilling across 625 million acres of U.S. coastal territory. It's ridiculous. I'll unban it immediately. I will unban it. I have the right to unban it immediately. What's he doing? Why is he doing it?
To clarify, President Biden did issue two presidential memoranda to protect vast areas from offshore oil leasing and drilling. But for those wondering, a presidential memorandum is a lot harder to rescind than an executive order, and undoing these on day one is not exactly realistic. It will take an act of Congress. I point this out because progress is in the details. As our regular listeners know, the thing we've been doing in preparation for Trump's second term is looking at Project 2025 and its policy suggestions as both chilling and glaring insight into what's coming and how we can fight back. You see, Project 2025 demonizes the Biden administration's climate policies and falsely minimizes the very complex impact of carbon emissions on everything from air quality to climate change. In addition to misleading the public, the document contains tons of recommendations to roll back environmental protections and gut the very agencies tasked with keeping our air and water clean and our communities safe. But there are glimmers of hope. For example, a recent victory in Deep Red, Montana, where the state Supreme Court ruled 6-1 that Montana was violating the residents' constitutional right to a clean environment by permitting oil, gas, and coal projects without regard for global warming. We might be tempted to assume Trump is going to win, but we'd be wrong. Our job is to understand what's threatened versus what's really possible, and then do something about it. Here to help us understand the most significant threats and opportunities is journalist Teak Root. He's a senior staff writer at GRIST, a nonprofit independent media organization dedicated to reporting on climate solutions and a just future. Teak has been following the Trump campaign and Project 2025's climate priorities. He's written stories from all over the world, and we're lucky that he's able to join us here today on Assembly Required. Teague, thank you so much for joining us here on Assembly Required.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to start with a big picture question. For those of us who watched Captain Planet, we understand that Donald Trump is no Dr. Blight, but can he wipe out 4 years of Biden's pro-environmental policies in a single term?
I think he can pause them and roll them back. It's a little bit unclear exactly how bad it will be, but it's not going to be good.
Okay. So no Dr. Blight.
The way I look at it is that it sort of depends on who comes next in the next administration after Trump. You saw Trump roll back a bunch of environmental regulations. Then you saw Biden put them back in. And with a lot of these things, they take, you know, years to really have major effects on, say, appliances or actual machines that are getting put out in the world. So this tug and, you know, pull and tug and pull between administrations, I think at the very least, we're looking at delayed climate action, which I think is going to be probably the biggest impact, right? We're headed well past 1 degrees Celsius of warming, towards 1.5, probably towards 2 degrees Celsius of warming. We don't have the time really to waste another 4 years of delays.
So thinking about what Biden has put in place and how much power Trump has to stall it out, which of the component pieces have had the greatest potential impact and therefore could be stalled out?
I think, you know, the rollback of the IRA is going to be a massive one. And I think stalling that will actually have more of an impact than some of the other things that can be done. But you are going to see Trump has vowed to stop leasing new land for offshore wind. I think that'll be major. And he's going to start leasing land for drilling and gas exploration. So I think you're going to start to see this shift away from an energy transition. It'll be pieces here and pieces there, but it's sort of going to be a lifeline for fossil fuels and sort of extend its life. And I think where you'll see the longest impacts is if it encourages new infrastructure that's going to last 30, 50, 100 years, and then you've baked in natural gas pipeline or whatever it might be, like a natural gas line to your house, that will be there for generations in a way that can't be undone. So I think it'll be sort of the sum of its parts, but it all encourages fossil fuel consumption and infrastructure build out in a way that I think over the long term will have climate impacts.
So let's stick with the IRA for a moment. So it is the most significant climate action legislation in American history. And a big piece of it looked at how despite the name Inflation Reduction Act, it was, I think, the most significant piece that, to your point, will have the longest shelf life was about how it changes our engagement with fossil fuels and with clean energy. Can you talk a little bit about some of the component pieces that were there? And as a part of that, what could Trump stop? What could he roll back? And what are things that are just moving too fast for him to, in his administration, to have real impact?
Yeah, so I think there are some things that consumers or most Americans will see the most. One is that EV, electric vehicle tax credit. So that is $7,500 on many new electric vehicles. You get a tax credit towards buying that. Home electrification and home energy efficiency, everything from weatherization to getting $800 to put in an induction stove in your home. So those are some of the consumer side ones and impacts that I think people will see a lot of. But then there are larger ones like encouraging utility scale solar and wind, and, you know, training workforces of contractors to be sort of literate in this world. So the range is huge. And of course, there are some controversial things like, you know, the support of hydrogen, which is often fossil fuel based. So we'll see exactly what Trump is able to roll back on his own. And it's mostly going to require congressional action or support. and he has, you know, such narrow majority in the House, we'll see what's possible. But tax credits, for example, all tax credits will have to be either repealed or changed by Congress. Trump cannot do that on his own. But what he can do is slow a lot of the spigot of money that's coming out. So, for example, the IRA had $9 billion to go towards state programs for home electrification and energy efficiency. Only about $3 billion of that has actually been awarded. And so it's an open question how, I think it's through the DOE, so how the next DOE administration handles that $6 billion of remaining money. I mean, by statute, they're required to to use it, but I think it can be really slowed, or it can be reprogrammed, or the awards can just not go through. Like, I think there's a lot of ways where, you know, the money, the tap can just be slowed down and just gummed up. And the administration has become smarter. So if you look at Trump's first term, they made a lot of sort of legal blunders in the beginning when they were trying to roll back rules, because they were new to sort of government bureaucracy and government, you know, rulemaking, et cetera. They made missteps that they aren't going to make this time. And so I think they will be as efficient as they possibly can in getting some of their agenda passed.
Well, let's stick with this for one more second. So let's talk about the state dollars that are going out through the IRA. A lot of those states have Republican senators. So those are states where if the money suddenly dry up and a neighbor has it in another state, if a cousin can say, I just got this money, but why can't we have it in our red state? Do you think that will have impact on particularly how senators are thinking about how they would vote on these repeals?
Yeah. So there's been $200 to $300 billion from the IRA sort of allocated already, and 70 to 80% of that has gone to Republican congressional districts. And you've seen, I think it was 18 Republican members of Congress write House Speaker Johnson to say, like, hey, like, these are, you know, there's some things here that we definitely want to save. And so he's, you know, Speaker Johnson has said that he wants to take a scalpel approach rather than a sledgehammer approach to the IRA. Trump has said he wants to take a sledgehammer approach to the IRA. So I think you're going to see this continued standoff between the House and Trump and the Senate also to a certain extent for how much of this actually gets done.
When climate scientists are thinking about what's happening in a second term, and I know you mentioned, you know, 2 degrees Celsius, can you talk a bit about what that means in terms of the emissions reduction targets that we set for 2030? And what do climate scientists think happen if we don't make any progress during the next 4 years?
Well, we're already on track to sort of miss climate targets. So this isn't going to help. And weirdly, if you look back at Trump's first term, there was a decrease in emissions. And I was reading a little bit about this recently, and there were sort of two reasons behind that. One was the global pandemic, right? Like, you know, the economies and everybody's use of everything fell off a cliff, which was a temporary decrease in emissions for the country. Another big one is that electricity demand remained low during Trump's first term, which allowed the sort of natural retirement of sort of coal and some of the power, like fossil fuel used to power plants. Electricity demand is growing, and there hopefully won't be another global pandemic. So emissions during Trump's second term seem very likely to not decrease, if not go up. So we are going to get further away from global and domestic emissions targets. And if we miss them, we're going to keep seeing the sort of natural disasters we've already been seeing in the U.S., right? Milton was a $1 billion storm. The number of $1 billion storms, or the average time between $1 billion storms, have gone from about 4 months to a matter of weeks. And so we're just going to keep, like, Vermont, which is often on every list of climate havens, right, where I am, has seen 100-year floods for the last few years. So these are the kind of impacts that you're going to start to see more of as the sort of needle rises.
Offshore drilling has been a tug of war for the last, I would say, 20 years. And each administration comes in trying to undo what the last administration did. On Monday of this week, I talked at the top of the program that Joe Biden actually issued a presidential memoranda using a provision of statute versus an executive order, essentially taking a lot of land and a lot of capacity for offshore oil drilling off of the table. And that decision to use a statute versus using an executive order has some real meaning when it comes to environmental regulations. Can you talk a little bit about what Biden did and why it matters?
Yeah, I mean, he took the entire Eastern Seaboard offline for oil drilling. He took parts of the Pacific Northwest, chunks of the Gulf of Mexico. I think it's pretty major. It's so new that I haven't delved too far into the statute versus executive order. I do know that I got an alert recently that Trump is obviously trying to already, reverse the ban, ban the ban, if you will. And so I think you'll see him try to do that. But my guess is it's going to the courts. And this is going to be a common theme. I think you're going to see a lot of climate rulemaking, a lot of climate legislation, a lot of climate everything end up in the courts over the next few years, which in a lot of ways is, I think, what conservatives want, right? Because if it ends up in the courts, it at least delays a lot of this stuff, if not, if not plays to their favor with a Supreme Court that is skewed conservative.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What do you want your 2025 story to be? Every new year creates the chance to write the next chapter of your story. We aren't defined by January resolutions that fade by February or plans from childhood that didn't quite pan out. We have the ability to change perspective and to alter the plot wherever we should. Think of therapy as your editorial partner, helping you write new chapters and create the meaningful story you deserve to live. In recent months, I've had the chance to recommend BetterHelp to friends who have grappled with the tumult of daily life, the trauma of major events, and the desire to reorient their way of thinking. I feel good suggesting BetterHelp because it's fully online, which makes therapy affordable and convenient for some who never thought they could seek support. BetterHelp serves over 5 million people worldwide who can access a diverse network of more than 30,000 credentialed therapists with a wide range of specialties. And they can easily switch therapists at any time with no extra cost. Write your story with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Abrams to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Abrams.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
Two of the people that he's appointed that would be overseeing these agencies, you've got Lee Zeldin, who's Trump's pick to lead the EPA, and you've got Chris Wright, who's his energy secretary. What can you tell us about former Representative Zeldin, about Chris Wright, and how concerned we should be about the roles that they will play leading these regulatory agencies?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Wright is or was the head of the world's largest fracking company, right? Like, he has been a climate skeptic, if not outright denier. So I think with the DOE, you're going to see, you know, them working with the Interior to sort of encourage oil and gas development, encourage drilling, and doing sort of whatever they can to sort of extend the lifeline of fossil fuels, which, to your point earlier, like, there are some market forces that are naturally happening. And I think you'll see the DOE start to push back against any sort of natural electrification, green transition rules and sort of momentum in any way that they can. I mean, you start, like, everything, like, the DOE controls such a huge swath, right? They're the ones that control how efficient your dishwasher is. They make Energy Star standards. So the impact can be, like, extremely wide. And I think it sometimes puts, not to focus on appliances, but I found, like, that's something that impacts people's lives a lot. And so the Biden administration strengthened appliance standards, but a lot of those don't come into effect until 2026, 2028. And so those will get rolled back. And then it puts these manufacturers in this place where do they, you know, how efficient are appliances? And sort of you sort of end up with a lot of the status quo a lot of the time. So I think you're going to see an impact there. And then, you know, Lee Zeldin is as the head of the APA. He said the IRA sucks, right? And he's, you know, an anti-regulation, America first, you know, policymaker. And so I think a lot of the Justice 40 initiatives, the environmental justice initiatives that the EPA was part of, I think you're probably going to see a lot of that dry up. And, you know, Project 2025 has called for an EPA, like, slashing its budget and slashing its authority. So I think he's going to be one of those rare federal agency heads that actually allows the curtailing of his own agency. And I think you saw this a bit during the first administration, where the EPA shifted from enforcement to sort of letting companies self-police. And I think you'll see a good chunk of that under Zeldin as well. And then some of my colleagues have written about this, but there's, like, sort of smaller, sneakier stuff that'll probably get undone too. For example, the EPA has looked into or called for is in the midst of implementing air monitoring around sort of oil refineries and oil infrastructure. And you'll probably see efforts like that paused or rolled back. And so I think you're going to see a lot of these little impacts on regulation that'll just creep up everywhere. And I know that during the first term, Trump had issued, I think it was an executive order that called for 2 regulatory rollbacks for every new regulation put in place. And I think he's vowed to up that to a 10-to-1 ratio.
Given that Lee Zeldin has this animus towards clean air, clean water, keeping, you know, communities free of chemicals and pesticides, and that this is Project 2025's, you know, one of their main core imperatives, how would you tell the average person, especially someone living in a red state, to think about what role and response they could have if they are watching their leaders side with those who are trying to make their lives harder? What would you say they should be thinking about?
Well, so that's the interesting thing, right? So Lee Zeldin or Trump won't say they're against clean water or clean air, right? Trump has called himself the most, have the cleanest water and the cleanest air under his presidency. And so I think what they are is they're anti-regulation. They're anti things that make it harder for companies to make money, such as scrubbers on power plants, right, that reduce emissions and pollutions in areas. So I think it's going to be sold as sort of pro-business, anti-regulatory, this will help your economy. But it's been proven over and over again that when those roadblocks and those watchdogs are taken away, you end up with less clean air and less clean water. And so I think it's going to be, you know, I think there's been movements in the first Trump administration towards sort of like citizen science and like monitoring air quality in the private sector or nonprofit sector, monitoring water quality in the nonprofit sector. So I think those sort of efforts are going to become more and more important. So I would just urge people to realize that the impacts are almost certainly going to be less clean water and less clean air, and just sort of look at ways that they can monitor that in their own house. And it sort of happened to me accidentally over the last like year or two. We've been trying to decarbonize our home. We had a gas stove, and last year my wife was pregnant, and we were about to have our first kid. And the summer before that, Vermont got a bunch of wildfire smoke from, I think it was Canada at the time, and it blew west. And so it was one of these first times, talk about climate impacts, is the first time Vermont had really bad wildfire smoke. So we bought an indoor air purifier that would, the light would go from green to red when there was some sort of, disturbance or pollutant in the atmosphere. So after, in the fall, after the wildfire smoke passed and we were back to sort of normal, we kept using this. And we noticed that every time we turned on our gas stove, the air purifier would kick up and turn sort of orange or red. And that, to us, was the impetus for going to an induction stove. Gas was obviously part of it, but these sort of environmental in our house daily impacts are really sort of have been driving some of our decision making. And so stuff like that, you can start to potentially, if you live near a oil facility, maybe try to get your own air monitor, look into, you know, state or local or nonprofit programs that would help fund an air monitor in your community. And then, you know, you don't have to listen to whether it be a Republican or a Democrat tell you how clean your air or water is. You can take a look for yourself.
I want to talk about that for a second, because I think what you've just offered are two very important activation steps. Like you said, we at this moment have to become our own monitors, our own hall monitors. And we live in a moment where there's technology available, but there's also a communication channel, multiple ones called social media, where you can start to let people know what you're learning. And we can, you know, we can crowdsource our own security. And I think the other piece that you laid out earlier is understanding that being anti-regulatory actually has meaning. And I think one of these opportunities is to think about the language that we're using when we're having these conversations. And I really appreciate the fact that you talk about who is being roadblocked by regulation, but what's on the other side of the roadblock? Who is on the other side? And so I think there's an opportunity for listeners to think about when you hear about a regulatory change, instead of just presuming that there's something that was inherently wrong with the regulation in the first place, ask questions. Why was that regulation in place? Can you talk a little bit for the average person who hasn't gone through a regulatory process? What are some of the key things for them to be listening for or looking to when regulations are being changed and how citizens can engage?
Yeah, just stepping back one second on your sort of citizen action thing. The other big plug I will make is for journalism, right? And I think a lot of outlets have started to do more sort of community focused journalism, and both journalists and also nonprofits often build in the digital age. It's gotten way easier to build these tools where you can type in your zip code and see what's happening where you are. So I'm thinking of the ProPublica did a formaldehyde investigation recently where you can type in your zip code and see what the formaldehyde risk might be in your neighborhood. And Rewiring America has a tool where you can type in your zip code and see what sort of electrification and energy efficient rebates are available to you. So just wanted to make a plug for those tools. Absolutely. Which I found really useful.
Plug away.
And on the regulatory side, the Federal Registry is where a lot of new rules or new proposed rules get placed. And then there's public comment periods. And that is a place where if there are issues that you're concerned about, I would just start typing in things you're concerned about and you can start to see what's happening there. You know, it can be a multiple, you know, many page rulemaking document, but the public comments I found actually distill a lot of the arguments and the controversial parts you probably care about really well. I've also found that if you have local politicians, whichever way you lean, left or right or wherever, they often have constituent email lists. And so I found that getting on those can be sometimes helpful to sort of figuring out what might be coming down the pipeline, or if there's a local nonprofit you like that follows housing, right? They might send out something to their email list about, hey, here's a new state or federal rule that you need to care about or should look at least. And they've usually do a pretty good job at flagging some of those things.
Assembly Required is brought to you by OneSkin. As we kick off the new year, I wanted to share a little secret. I don't do big resolutions. Instead, I review my past year and think about what I want to know or have accomplished 365 days later. Some of my ambitions are about feeling better in my body, and that includes using OneSkin. Only OneSkin has the OS1 peptide, the first ingredient to target cellular senescence, a root cause of aging responsible for lines, wrinkles, and crepey skin. With OneSkin's groundbreaking approach, you're not just helping your skin look and feel younger and healthier on the surface, you're helping it behave better at the cellular level, so you'll see improvements now and in the future. Remember, it's the small habits that add up to big changes. So whether you're looking for a scientifically proven cleanser, moisturizer, sunscreen, or a whole new routine, we love the Complete Skin Longevity Regimen here. OneSkin can seriously transform your skin. Give it 12 weeks and see for yourself. Make 2025 the year you invest in habits that keep your skin healthy and help you look your best. Use code ASSEMBLY for an exclusive 15% off at oneskin.co. OneSkin sunscreen is on my list of habit-forming products. OneSkin believes the purpose of skincare is not just to improve how you look, but to optimize your skin's biology at the cellular level so it's more resilient to the aging process. Founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists, OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS1 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. Get 15% off with code ASSEMBLY at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code ASSEMBLY. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
I want to talk about someone who's made getting good information harder in recent years, and that's Elon Musk. This is someone who made his name by leveraging federal funds to actually bolster his business interest in electric vehicles. And now he's working for a climate denier who wants to reverse the intention. So how do you square who Elon Musk was and who he is? And I don't want you to get into the psychology, but I would love your thinking about how the intersection of Musk and Tesla and just his business interest with Doge, and also how they will take on fossil fuels in this new administration, given the real cost to consumers for supporting the fossil fuel industry.
So I think it boils down to self-interest or sort of business interest, as you mentioned. Early in Tesla's existence, sort of the federal subsidies, I think it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars for some of the R&D stuff. And then, you know, probably more than that in sort of tax credits for their Teslas earlier on. Because for those who may not have followed closely, Tesla hit sort of production cap limits and so was ineligible for a while for some of these EV tax credits. So early on, those were very important to Tesla. But now Tesla isn't as reliant on federal tax credits as other companies like, you know, GE or Stellantis or those other American car companies. So now And he's even said this, the EV tractors will hurt those companies way more than they'll hurt Tesla. So I think that sort of squares that circle for me, at least, is he doesn't stand to lose nearly as much from getting rid of the EV tax credits as other companies do. As for whether they'll take on fossil fuels, I actually wrote about this the other day on a suggestion from my editor, because this idea that they want to cut $2 trillion or roughly a third out of the federal budget, you're going to need a pretty big axe to do that. And there are a lot of subsidies for fossil fuels and you know, in the range of billions, and then, you know, even more for stuff like ethanol, based fuels, corn-based ethanol. So I think it'll be a real, one person I talked to called it a truth test, or like a litmus test for how committed they are to this idea of just slashing government subsidies and support writ large. But almost no one I talked to expected them to actually go after fossil fuels, right? In theory, it's possible. But we don't know anything really about Doge yet, right? We don't know whether it's going to operate inside or outside the government, or where it's going to sit, or, you know, how are Elon and Ramaswamy going to go toe-to-toe with cabinet secretaries? Like, are they going to get, more access to Trump? I think there's so many questions. But in theory, if they're slashing sort of subsidies, there's a lot that could be slashed that also apply to fossil fuels. But by and large, the expectation is that it's going to hurt climate policy and sort of the green transition as they start to cut government supports.
You've been writing and thinking a lot about market forces, and Elon Musk and his coterie represent a fairly significant part of that. But how do you think about how market forces will play into addressing climate change in this administration? And can you explain your thinking and why you think this is an angle that we need to focus on?
The first two words that come to my mind are heat pumps, or maybe it's one word, but I think it's two. Heat pumps are, I think, a perfect example of how market forces are really playing out here. The industry is now selling more electric heat pumps than they are gas boilers. And this trend started before the IRA. People are realizing that they can heat and cool their homes at the same time, often, especially if you don't live in extreme climates, for less money, with less breakdown. So I think that is a prime example of product and market that has just gone somewhat independently of government regulation and started to take over. I think you've seen the costs of renewable energy, so solar and wind, just especially at utility scale, but also somewhat at the household scale, just plummet. And that has had nothing to do, or not nothing, but large, that's also been happening independent of U.S. domestic climate policy. I think the one wrench that Trump has threatened and almost certainly will throw into market forces is tariffs. This is just a big lever that he has at his disposal that he said he will already use. And I think there was news the other day that he's now considering more universal tariffs rather than targeted tariffs, which makes it harder to circumvent by going and importing through a different country. So I think that is the biggest way in which Trump can probably disrupt the market forces behind a green transition. And also, I think there's some of this rebate money could change people's calculus on whether a heat pump or something makes sense. But often, from people I've talked to and even myself, like, they're on par regardless of subsidies, and subsidies just help. And I think you're going to see both tariffs and a change in rebates. Who that's really going to impact is lower income consumers. And last year the IRS released data that there were $8 billion or so dollars of tax credits claimed by people, like energy efficiency tax credits claimed by people. And the majority of those fell, or the bulk of those fell in the $100,000 to $200,000 income range. So already you're seeing that the green transition is something that, you know, upper middle class is gravitating towards. And I think tariffs and rolling back rebates will only accelerate that and make it less accessible for lower income individuals. But I do think a lot of this is headed down a path anyway, right? Like the federal government has very little say over whether somebody, a business or your home, decides to install electric vehicle charger. And like that sort of stuff will continue to happen as people need them and businesses decide that they're worth the investment.
So I'm going to give you a really simple, easy, low stakes question to take us out of here. One of the side effects we know of the climate change conversation is what's described as climate despair. When it all just feels too overwhelming and too hopeless, we give in and potentially give up. So here on Assembly Required, what we try to provide are antidotes to that despair. We try to invite guests on who help us wrap our heads around complicated topics like you have and who help us brainstorm on ways to take action. And you have given us a great deal of, I think, incredibly useful information. But when you are doing this work day after day, when you are trying to make certain that monitor in your home doesn't tell you that the appliances in your home are going to cause you harm, when you're reporting and you're writing about so many topics that can be overwhelming, how do you keep yourself from just giving up?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So I generally cover climate change nationally and internationally. So I found actually some solace in sinking a lot of effort into my own home. Like I just spent hours and hours thinking about how I could do this in my own life. And I found it weirdly comforting, right? Like I didn't have to think about the emissions going over China and Europe. I could just sort of think about my house for a little bit. And I find that really enjoyable. And I really liked, like, I don't know if I'm just a nerd, but I really like talking to my public utility about like what programs they had to help me reduce, you know, energy. And like, there's so many cool, like there's this utility in California that started to just offer people heat pumps instead of replacing the natural gas pipeline, especially in rural communities where they only have like three houses at the end. And those are programs that if you just ask, you'll find out about and you might actually be eligible for. There's just so much out there that I didn't know about when I started doing this. So I found focusing on the local and even hyper-local level has really been quite enjoyable. And a lot of the local journalism right now on environmental reporting is really fascinating. Like in Georgia, a lot of the work that was done on the nuclear plant that's opening there, I think is something that like, I think people can stay engaged in, and it doesn't necessarily feel like big climate policy that you're engaging in. It's sort of a local issue that could affect your community, but does have those implications. So broadly, I would say just sort of think about touch points in your daily life. Like as you walk around, like whether it's your car or like the fossil fuel that goes into making the rubber, the plastic in your cookware, or like, I think there's just so many touch points, and find out what's important to you. Kids, right? I've heard so many people say that they started to care about climate change because their kids started talking about it after learning about greenhouse gas emissions in school or talking to their friends about it. For me, sports is often, like, I think a lot about, like, down the road for me, I have a semi-pro soccer team where climate justice is their mission, right? So, like, I often find weird ways into it. Electrifying muscle cars, I heard someone got into as a way of, like, as a touch point for this. So, you know, almost anything can potentially do it.
Well, Teek Root, thank you so much for being on Assembly Required.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Week, we want to leave the audience with a new way to act against what can feel inevitable, an opportunity to make a difference, a way to get involved, or just get started on working out a solution. We call the segment Our Toolkit. At Assembly Required, we encourage the audience to be curious, solve problems, and do good. So let's start with being curious. Read more of Teek and his colleagues' excellent climate change reporting on grist.org. You can also find valuable information on insideclimatenews.org, which produces nonpartisan environmental journalism. And as we talked about, you can take matters into your own hands. Get a monitor, sign up for a newsletter, do the work of telling your community what you know and what you're learning. Don't wait for the government to do its job when you can help move it along. Now, in addition to what Teek and I discussed, we know that for solving problems and doing good, it's not enough to just want to do it. We need to think about how we get it done. And one of the ways we're approaching that are through our listener questions. Before the holidays, I offered some recommendations for our first two steps. One, identifying an issue that matters to you the most and being as local as you can about how you address it. Two, I encourage you to figure out who is in charge and who can make the change you want to see, what we refer to in organizing as power mapping. For step three, I want to turn to a question from listener Tyler Zog. Tyler writes, "Stacy, I'm about to graduate with a bachelor's in statistics in the spring. I've also recently decided I want my career to be something that improves the world in some way and doesn't just improve shareholder value. I was hoping for a Harris victory for many reasons, but a big part is because I was hoping to get a research job in the EPA or CDC, or one of the many organizations Project 2025 seeks to remove. With a Trump victory, is it worth seeking a government job? Do I look at nonprofits or other research-focused organizations, or are they at the same risk with likely removal of government funds? In short, how can we help continue vital research into health, the environment, civil rights issues, etc., when we face an administration that seems to be outright hostile to said research? I'd appreciate your advice." Well, first of all, congratulations, Tyler. And I want to use your question because I want to talk about step three in organizing, in advocacy, and in just responding to what's coming. Step three is that once we know what we're concerned about and we know who's responsible, it's time to become our own resident experts. This conversation today with Teek was a great example of the ways we can do that. But it's not just enough for us to do it on our own, in our homes, in our communities. This is where people like Tyler come in, because we need experts in the field and in positions of power. So I'll say this, Tyler, while it is difficult to work for an administration whose values don't align with yours, we have to remember that the government works for the people, not the politicians. Most government jobs are actually apolitical. I had a sister who worked for the CDC for years. And I can tell you that no matter who she worked for, the science didn't change. And what that means is that you don't have to excel at politics to do your job. More importantly, you have to focus on the substance of your work. That's where we need you, and that's what you studied for. Now, more than ever, we need good people in government jobs who are willing to do the research the right way. Yes, there will be constraints on how you can do your work, but the fundamentals remain. We need folks like you to help folks like us learn about the topics and potential solutions. For those who are trying to use this research, I want you to identify who studies what you care about or who has written a paper or a blog on the topic. As Teek described, look for newsletters that focus on that area of interest and give you a summary once a week about what's going on. Even better, reach out to them. The worst case scenario is that the person you reach out to ignores you and you move on. But if not, if they do come back, you now have a firsthand resource to help deepen your understanding of the topic. So I would invite this resource to join you in a Zoom meeting with your group. This can be a very effective way for an introvert, for example, to convene people without having to actually talk. So you do the work of setting up the learning opportunity and you let someone else do the talking. We know that when we learn more, we are better equipped to do more. And folks like Tyler can help us make that happen. But everyone listening to the show has the ability to become a resident expert on something that matters to you. So to recap, step one, know your target. Step two, know who's in charge. And step three, know who knows more than you and learn from them. No matter what our target is, we need to be prepared. So again, over the next few episodes, we'll continue our organizing and insistence training. Because once we get started, we're going to get a lot of good done. If you want to tell us what you've learned and solved, send us an email at assemblyrequired@crooked.com or leave us a voicemail. Your questions and comments might be featured on the pod. Our number is 213-293-9509. Well, that wraps up this episode of Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams. I'll meet you here next week. Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is a Crooked Media production. Our lead show producer is Alona Minkowski, and our associate producer is Paulina Velasco. Kirill Polaviv is our video producer. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Our theme song is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Thank you to Matt DeGroat, Kyle Seglin, Tyler Boozer, and Samantha Slosberg for production support. Our executive producers are Katie Long, Madeline Herringer, and me, Stacey Abrams.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.